Oh my God, the wheels do keep turning. I know we are dreadfully late this morning. This is Babs or Else Ivy. You're listening to Love Babs Love Talk. Harry is back from vacation and the station is a mess. So he's got to spend some time getting us right. So anyway, I have a guest this morning. Dennis Cullerton is here from the Witness Stone Project. And so we met like last week. Go ahead, put your headphones on. We met last week and had coffee over at Cafe X because the universe has been trying to connect us. Like my friend Andrew Kaplan, the good folks at the Graustein Memorial Fund. So people were trying to connect us, which was amazing. How are you?
Great.
Welcome.
Thank you.
So I'm fascinated and awed by this Witness Stone project. Tell us what it is.
Okay, the Witness Stones project is a project to memorialize and to restore the history of slavery here in Connecticut and in the North.
There was slavery in Connecticut?
Well, if I told you how many adults who grew up here and went to school here asked that question of me, you would be surprised.
No, I wouldn't.
Okay. But and it started with my friend Doug Nygren coming back from Germany after hearing, and he did hear one of my talks at the library in Guilford about my research while I was still an eighth grade teacher, and he said, could we remember slavery in Connecticut and in Guilford the way they remember the Holocaust in Germany by putting a stone in the ground about the size of half of a paving brick to mark the place where people were held in captivity here in Connecticut. And when he brought the idea to me, the joke I always tell is that if you bring a sore knee to a surgeon, they're going to want to operate. Well, you bring an idea to a teacher, he's going to want to make, or she's going to want to make it a lesson. So I understood my research enough to know that we could use the information to begin to tell the stories of enslaved people, individual enslaved people who helped build our communities.
Mm-hmm.
And we built an organization around that. And so far, we've put between Guilford and West Hartford, we put 18 stones in the ground, and we're spreading to other communities as we speak.
So now, how did you come to this? I mean, beyond having a conversation with a friend. I mean, because something had to spark your interest to say, oh, I want to do this. Yeah. I think you're a budding historian or historian of sorts.
We'll go with historian of sorts, I like to say. Amateur. But it really came to me because, you know, I moved to Guilford about 25 years ago, and I was always intrigued with the history. It's like New Haven, it was settled in the 1630s, and who are these people? Why were they here? And the daughter, we call her maybe the granddaughter of Guilford, Harriet Beecher Stowe's mother and father grew up in Guilford, and I was always intrigued by her story and how she came to write the book Uncle Tom's Cabin, who President Lincoln said she was the little lady who helped start this great war. Well, I started going back to her childhood after her mother died in Litchfield, Connecticut, and found out she came back to Guilford and lived in a household that held two black people captive. Harvey the Bound Boy and Black Dinah. And I was just kind of trying to understand how Harriet Beecher Stowe lived in a house with slaves. And that brought me to trying to understand how many slaves there were and who were they and where did they come from and who held them. And so I ended up doing a lot of research just trying to answer the next question that came up after finding a document. For example, we have a document where a woman named Dinah was purchased by the Board of Selectmen in Guilford in 1792. Now, I have about 1,000 questions with that document, but you could see how you could easily kind of start going down that rabbit hole.
Yeah.
And I came up with...
Because you want to know, like...
You want to know why.
Okay, what is going on here?
Who are these people, and why are they enslaving people, and what was going on here, and what was going on after they were set free, what happened? So all these questions came up, and I just spent a lot of time and hours going to archives in Hartford and going online. Ancestry.com has some amazing stuff these days, and just spending hours and hours and collecting it. And in a sense, Doug gave me an avenue to share this information. I don't know if I'll ever have time to write a book, but it's a blessing to be able to share the research and try to begin to make a difference, because as we realize what information we had and what ideas we had, we also realized that in America, we haven't done the truth yet mm-hmm. about slavery. Mm-hmm. So if you go to Germany, I went to South Africa, you go to other countries, they've done truth and reconciliation.
Yes.
And we haven't done the truth yet. So we're trying to do our little part,
yeah.
but also having the kids tell the truth, having mm-hmm. the kids use these documents to write stories.
So yeah. I think in America, we want reconciliation without telling the truth.
Yeah.
I do believe that's probably why we have the breakups that we have, the disconnect that we have, because we want reconciliation before truth telling.
Right.
So what did you find most amazing about this work? I mean, were you expecting to find so many enslaved people in Connecticut? In Guilford? I mean, were you stunned by that? I mean, I would have been stunned by that, kind of.
And I think luckily it came to me on a trickle. So you take one piece of information and you grab another piece. But I was shocked at who owned the enslaved people. Mm-hmm. I think I was kind of shocked.
Because it was leadership. It was like town leadership.
Like the ministers, like the pastors of the church, the leadership. And people say, well, it was okay in those days. And I said, have you ever read the Bible? Have you ever read about Moses, this guy bringing his people away from slavery? He knew what was wrong.
Yeah.
And we didn't know what was wrong. Read the Bible a couple times. And if you put yourself in the place of who, if you start thinking about the Bible and the idea of the other.
Mm-hmm.
So for the Egyptians, the Israelites were the other. So you could treat them that way. But if you picture yourself as an Israelite, being treated as a slave was wrong. And that was, that's from the beginning of our country was our society is if you can do a lot of awful things to people if you
don't see them as people.
If you don't see them as people.
Yes. And if you see them as other, you will.
Right. And that was shocking to me, because the people that we celebrate in our communities, mm-hmm. whose names are on the building and whose stories we tell, that's how they thought. And not every single one of them, but that's how they thought. So for someone to say it's okay to enslave someone, and it was okay because that's what people did, are missing the fact, because if you put yourself in the shoes of the person who's being enslaved, you say, that was wrong.
Yeah.
It was wrong all day, every day.
Yeah.
So part kind of getting our brain around that this dehumanization that allows you to treat someone as an other is the beginning of that story.
Yeah.
Even with the students, when we talk about how do we look at these documents and we talk about dehumanization, you can, the parallels with Nazism and the Holocaust. But, I even go so far and have gone so far as to say, we have a leader who was dehumanizing people who crossed the border. And then 6 months later, he was using language to say they're criminals, they're rapists, they're drug dealers. And then 6 months later, we find that children are in cages. Is not a surprise, because the dehumanization happened.
Yes.
The words happened and then the actions happened.
Mm-hmm.
So we can see the parallels today. We can see them in Nazi Germany.
Well, that's the joy of history.
Yes.
That it will teach you. And if you don't learn it, you are doomed to repeat it.
Right.
And we seem to be in that repeating mode.
We seem to be in that repeating mode right now. Yes.
You know.
Yes. But certainly, the excitement comes with the discovery. I thought probably about 5 years ago, I found everything there is to find. And then you open a new book, or you pull a new string, or
and you're like, whoa.
And look at what we have here.
Mm-hmm.
And you find new techniques. So, mm-hmm. But it's amazing to me that the information is there. I do believe it's hidden history. You can get a book of the history of Guilford or New Haven or someplace, and you might find a few lines in a paragraph about slavery. And then to be able to find all this documentation that not only were there so many enslaved people, but they were held in the households of the leading, members of society.
Mm-hmm.
And that wasn't mentioned when we talk about those people. Yale did a very good job in, I think, 2001, looking at their relationship with slavery. And they might want to republish that, because now people are really starting to, that's coming back. But with all that information, they couldn't get around the corner when it came to renaming the college.
I know, right?
Yeah, they couldn't. They had the most wonderful information about their complicity with slavery.
Yeah.
And they couldn't.
And they named the college with the understanding that they knew they were trying to recruit or solicit or invite folks of that thinking to come to that college.
Yeah.
Like, there was a reason why they named it. It wasn't because he did great things. It was because.
Yeah, because he
because he had a belief, and they wanted those students to come.
Yeah, and so they weren't able to. You know, they did turn the corner. You know,
well they did.
They did turn the corner with a little help
scrutiny
from a custodian, put a broom through a window, a mop. But yes, they had the research to support them thinking a different way. So
yeah.
That was interesting to see. And you know, God bless them that they did the research and they came up and they published that. But
yeah.
It maybe needs to, you know.
And, you know, they're celebrating 50 years of African-American studies at Yale right now.
Right.
Which is, you know, weird, but 50 years.
Right.
Which is a short period of time in the whole scheme of the information they've been sitting on.
Yeah.
So how does the town of Guilford take this? I mean, do they side-eyed you? Do they welcome it? Are they excited? Why are you digging this up? Why are you, you know, all these things that make people feel maybe ashamed or embarrassed or couldn't possibly be Guilford. You must be mistaken.
Yeah, I found so much support and support from when we first started this. We realized we wanted to put these stones on or about the sidewalks in town, and that's all town property. So we went before the Board of Selectmen. I remember not realizing that that the press was going to be there. They had, you know, the Guilford Public Television. They had someone from the Guilford Courier, and I brought to them the document where the enslaved woman Dinah was purchased by the Board of Selectmen, and I'll tell you, they looked at that document and they looked up and they said, what can we do to help this project? And they took it upon themselves. So here we have the first selectman, Joe Mazza, whose parents were Italian immigrants, and Cindy Cartier, and the names were all, you know, European names of people who came during whose families came after this Civil War and after the Emancipation Proclamation. But they took it upon themselves to say, this is our history. These are our forebears,
So they didn't shy away.
They didn't shy away. What can we do to help? And then having the students tell the stories, I think, blunts a lot of the criticism, because the students are using these documents. They're using church records and probate records and vital records and inventories after somebody dies and anecdotes of where there are these brief stories out there. And if you hear it from the mouth of babes, it's telling the truth. You know, it's not fake news. It's the truth.
Mm-hmm.
People seem to be able to accept it better than if you or I came in and, you know, said, boom, you know, this is the way it is. But we've had a really upswelling of positive responses. We speak at the library in Guilford often, and we get, you know, oftentimes standing room only crowds who come in and want to learn more about it, and then they ask, what can we do next?
Mm-hmm.
So we've had a lot of wonderful support. I've heard whispers of, why we got to dig this up, and you know, how's this going to help us in the future? And there's a lot of answers to that, but one of them is, if you see the world today and you think everything's great, well, then you're doing okay. But if you look at the world and say, we need to make some changes, sometimes you have to look backwards and to be able to move forward.
Mm-hmm.
You have to say, why are we in this situation? You know, why are our schools in Connecticut segregated?
Mm-hmm.
Why is it that, you know, New Haven schools are majority minority and Guilford schools are vast, 90% white or whatever the numbers are, and you know, what changes could be made, and why are we in this situation? So I think most people are open to it, but there are people who, you know, we know today's politics, they don't want to hear it.
Mm-hmm.
They want
to. So how do you get young people to get involved? Where do these students come from? How do you get them?
Well, we do it as a classroom activity,
mm-hmm.
and really we bring the kids through.
Because you are a retired teacher now?
Retired teacher, but I'm still working with the wonderful teachers at Guilford Public Schools. And in West Hartford, we we gave a workshop for retired teachers up there who are in classroom teachers, and they're bringing it to the classrooms in West Hartford. It's really designed around a middle school eighth grade activity. Mm-hmm. But it can be done at other ages. We're also working with two independent schools this year, and one in Sacred Heart, Greenwich, and another one is the Country School in Madison.
I find it interesting that these are very white schools.
Yes.
Like, these are, you can't get whiter than these schools.
Well, West Hartford is about 40% students of color. Mm. And a lot
I didn't realize that.
A lot of them are you know, East Asian or South Asian. Mm-hmm. But a lot of, there are, parts of West Hartford that are, African American and Hispanic American areas, but it is, and part of it, part of it, I think, has to do with the, and this is my own feeling, I haven't done any research, but I think these towns aren't as worried, the prep schools or the independent schools aren't as worried. They don't do the testing, the smarter balance testing. I think Guilford, they are at a good place, so they're not worried. They don't have the data board on the wall, and they're not looking at the test scores. They're not being, there's principals.
So they have time.
They have time, or they've figured out that they have time. Mm-hmm. Certainly, I would be excited to bring this to a place like New Haven or Bridgeport or Hartford, because I think the project has a different, I'll get a different understanding, and the students will, because there's also what we call, inclusive curriculum, where mm-hmm. the curriculum includes people who look like the kids in front of them.
Novel.
And instead of telling, the story of the, Irish potato famine, which is a wonderful and important story, maybe we're telling a story that represents the kids that we're teaching. And so bringing it to New Haven or Hartford, and bringing it to a way, because we don't, we try to make... We try to make, through the work, have the enslaved people not as victims, but as whole people. Part mm-hmm. of their restoring their humanity is not saying how badly they were treated, but how they acted and how they had agency in their own life, even within the confines of slavery. So this idea of agency and resistance is a big part of how we teach this, or how the kids find the information, because we need them to know that. That these folks were fully human, mm-hmm. and that they had the same thoughts and desires and hopes that other folks did. And it's not easy to squeeze that out of the research we have, because that isn't something maybe the people who were collecting the information 200 years ago.
Yeah, they weren't thinking that they were people. They were just concerned about capturing information.
Yeah, and they were, habitual about it. So they mm-hmm. wanted to write down everybody who died, and they wanted to write down all this other information. But we can see through it, and there's new ways of analyzing. And even, sometimes enslaved women in the North were told not to have children mm-hmm. because at a certain point, slavery didn't make as much sense economically in the North. And sometimes they did anyway, and that could be considered a form of resistance, as bringing your family forward, going to the next generation, or running away. We see all these runaway slave ads, and that's a form of resistance. And mm-hmm. And I think when I was younger, I would say, oh, they did something wrong. And now it's like, no, they did something really right. Mm-hmm. They took their choice of what they had, and they ran with it, even if they were carrying all these things, because these runaway slave ads are great, because they tell us exactly what the enslaved person looked like, what they were wearing, if they had any, if they were had all their fingers. But we get the best description we'll ever have of an enslaved person is in an ad of somebody trying to capture them.
Mm-hmm.
So there's all these techniques that we're using in trying to show their humanity, and that's important too. I would say, living in a place like Guilford, which I do, and I love it there, if I watch TV, as mm-hmm. what I see about African Americans is usually something to do with a, video police blotter. It's, mm-hmm. This is the awful things that are happening. Not all the wonderful things that are happening in New Haven, not all the wonderful achievements, but we're seeing, who's being arrested, who stole the car, and things like that. So for our kids to see a different version of African American history versus what's on, not that they watch the news anymore, they really don't. But so that's important too, to see a different, to have a different description that they're creating using these documents.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So what do you like to see happen with the Witness Stone project?
Well, I retired this past June so we could, you know, take it and try to bring it to other folks. So, you know, I used to say it feels like it has legs, but it's something that can be brought to other communities. There's some heavy lifting. So you can't go to New Haven and say, oh, here's a project and do it, because there is somebody who needs to go out and dig up the research of the enslaved people here. Most communities, we know of some people who are enslaved, and there's usually a story about a Moses or a Pompey mm-hmm. or a Phyllis or a Dinah.
Yeah.
That somebody, you could find somebody, say, I could tell that story.
I mean, we've got the Sinkay story, the Amistad story, yeah, which is pretty big.
It's a great story, and that, you know, so there's stories that can be, that are already available to be done, but really what I would like to, you know, I would like to envision that we can bring this and start to spread it across Connecticut and across other states with teachers and researchers. You know, in a place like New Haven, I think you need to partner with the New Haven Historical Society to be able to bring this to the classroom.
Yeah,
that's the partnership. Most historical societies would love to be able to have a way to bring eighth graders into their place.
Have you had a conversation with the New Haven Historical Society?
I've begun to.
Okay.
And they're
nice people over there.
They're wonderful people. And, you know, I find people are busy. They have a lot of wonderful things that are doing. I think through this project, I've begun to find so many good things that folks are doing already. And they're mm-hmm. looking at this as being an addition to the
good things
they're doing. So I recently had a conversation in Deerfield, Massachusetts with Historic Deerfield. They interpret around the enslaved people who lived in Historic Deerfield, but they're saying, how can we interpret it even better? And so they're looking at bringing this in as a way to, you know, bring in these eighth graders or bring in these middle school kids and to start looking at specific documents about individuals instead of talking generally about, you know, slavery in mm-hmm. that particular community. So there's great stuff. This June I was part of the Hempstead House's Juneteenth celebration.
Yeah.
And there was a wonderful, you know, I was on a panel discussion there, and they had, I'm going to forget his name, but the African American man who's doing the slave dwelling project, and he goes around the country and stays overnight in places where enslaved people lived.
Oh, God.
And he goes at plantations, and he started to go north and finding these places where enslaved people
live. That is incredible.
And I'm gonna remember his name soon, but he is amazing. I got to sit on a panel with him and understand what he's doing, because he'll come in the day before and work with the school kids, and then maybe they'll have a campfire that night and bring in people from the community to have a kind of a an informal roundtable discussion.
Oh, that makes me hopeful.
Yeah, and then he might, you know, they might have a dinner with him. And but that slave dwelling, it's slavedwelling.org. He's doing amazing work, and you know, and he's finding people are like, oh, here we are. You know, we have a house in Guilford that's been around since the time of slavery, and we believe that Candace lived in this room. So we're beginning to think about how could we bring him to Guilford, and what. You know, again, how many minds will be like, wow, I didn't know, you know, like, not only did I not know it, I'm now understanding differently about the Highland House because of who lived there.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't just the, you know, white people who owned it, whose names are on the building. It was all these people. And that was all part of the success of the families that were there. That's why they were able to build that big house that's still around 300 years later.
Yeah. So.
Joe McGill. See, I knew.
Good.
Joe McGill.
Joe McGill.
Yes.
I didn't even know that existed. So I'm going to go look that up.
Yeah, he's got a great blog because he goes and stays places and he talks
about. I don't know if I could do that. It takes a special kind of person to do that kind of history finding.
And he's also, you know, I think one of his most common questions is, and he said this, is that people ask him, how can you not be angry? How could this not stick in your craw? How could you not want to spit when you go to a place and you see how awfully people like your ancestors were treated? And he says, I don't want to misquote him, but he says, if I was an angry black man, no one would listen to me.
Mm.
And that to me was, you know, it just helped me understand how he's able to go mm-hmm. and stay at a place where he knows that people were you know, beaten to death, or he knows that children were, you know, left to starve or places like that. But he's saying, I need to keep my cool.
I think that's every black person in America, because we could have burned this country down in 1619, but we didn't. So,
well, yeah, but his voice is very loud through his gentleness. You know, through his gentle voice, he's very.
I'm gonna go look. I'm gonna find this. Yeah. I find that fascinating. So, it's an actual stone that you place where a particular enslaved person lived, and it's their name and their what else is on this stone, and is there a map showing where they all are?
Well, we're beginning to do that. We felt that if we can do this for 5 years, we would like to put up a permanent interpretive sign with a QR code on it. So in 5 years, we'll have 15 stones, for instance, placed in Guilford. And then you would be able to go up and say, because they're not all going to be beside each other, although many of them are going to be around the green. And so we're doing these beautiful maps. And I think I gave you a copy of a postcard that we're doing, and we have a bookmark, but we also want to do more of an interactive map where you could click on it and get part of the story of that person.
And do you connect it to the Freedom Trail?
We're working on that. I'm also,
because that would make sense to me.
It makes sense to me too, and I'm a board member on the Connecticut Freedom Trail.
And they just did Judge Constance Baker Motley.
Yes.
Her previous home in wherever it is in Connecticut.
Yeah, I'm sorry, it might be Vernon or whatever it was.
And I just got the information the other day about it, and they just recognized her home is part of the Freedom Trail,
right?
You know,
and I'm on the board of the Freedom Trail, and they're very excited about the work we're doing, and I'm still letting things, I don't know what the word is, ripen or get to a point where we have more more to share, but we're trying to show through our website witnessstones.org the work we're doing and connecting to the work in West Hartford, and now the work that's going to be done this year in Madison and in Greenwich.
Wow.
So we're expanding the story that way. The stones themselves that look so much like the Stolperstein, the stones that are put in the ground for the Jews who were captured or kidnapped and murdered under the Holocaust, that's our model. And we asked them permission. So we went to them and said, this is what we want to do. Is it okay if we model ourselves after what you're doing in Germany? And the folks at the Stolperstein, which means stumbling stones in German, they said, yeah, you can do, please do it. We understand the relationship between the Holocaust and the transatlantic slave trade. So the stones that we have the name of the enslaved person. We try to find through the records what they did for a living. So
like they could have been cook.
They could have been a cook. They could have been a miller,
blacksmith, or something.
And we sometimes try to get that from other documents. We can sometimes get that from the wills of the slaveholder. That
Oh, that's right, because they would be. I mean, because they were chattel property, right? So,
but they also would oftentimes still be left something. So they might be left a spinning wheel or cooking pots or something like that. There's a couple of anecdotes out there. So we know that Candace, for instance, made wedding cakes. So she was a baker. That was like her side job after she was freed, was she made wedding cakes. We know her mother, Phyllis, she inherited two different types of spinning wheels. I think one for flax and one for wool. So we know she was a spinner.
Mm-hmm.
Phyllis's son, Moses, according to Lyman Beecher, Harriet Beecher Stowe's father, he ran the farm, he rang the church bell, he was a factotum, which it means a jack of all trades. He sent Reverend Fowler's son to Yale, and he was considered a king of the slaves. So we can't put all that on a stone, because the stones are really 4 inches by 4 inches. So we put Moses, factotum, king of the slaves, and we say when he was there around, if we know exactly when he was there in that particular place, we'll take the beginning or the end, or we might say circa 1760, which means we know he lived here around 1760.
Are there headstones for these people? Are they buried somewhere? Are they, like, what happened to them? Do we know?
Well, we know that we only have one extant headstone of an enslaved person in Guilford. So I have records on 85. I would guess it was easily twice as many enslaved people over time who don't show.
I mean, because now we're finding all these slave burial grounds all over the place, right? So
unmarked.
And
what we have things from the 1930s when during the Great Depression, they sent all these like professors and people out into the field to do things. So they you know, there's records of, we know in the back corner of the, you know, of the church burial ground, there were people with unmarked graves, and they were oftentimes paupers and enslaved people. Like I say, we have one marker for Shem, who was held by, I think it was Simeon and Submit Chittenden.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't Submit a nice name for a wife?
Mm.
But
Lord have mercy,
Simeon and Submit, and he has an extant, you know, stone that we know it's right up on top of a hill in Guilford, across from the Congregational Church there. But most of the people who were buried in Guilford for the first 200 years were buried on the Guilford Green, and then all those stones were removed,
mm-hmm,
and placed at two other graveyards or cemeteries. We believe that most of the enslaved people in Guilford are buried on the green and are still there, or their remains are there, but we don't have any records and we don't have any stones.
Mm-hmm.
But I would say also all the paupers and all the, you know, folks who couldn't afford a stove, you know, so when they moved when they took the graveyards off the green, they took the stones and, in New England,
and left the
In New England, you know, we know, just like New Haven Green, after the last hurricane, I think they found some bone chips under the roots of these big trees.
And Worcester Square, Worcester Square,
right? So we know they're there, and we believe that many in some towns, the churches fought like heck to baptize and marry and bury the enslaved people. In other towns, not so much.
Mm-hmm.
So you can find these wonderful church records. Middletown, between the Anglican Episcopal Church and the Congregational Church, there are records of 250 enslaved people who lived in Middletown.
Wow.
And just in the church records. And that's not even, you know, diving into the vital records or the probate records or things like that. So because these two ministers, it felt like they were competing to, you know, to
save some souls or.
Yeah, but in other places, not so much. You know,
wow.
You could find church records of towns or cities that had many, many enslaved people, and there's not a mention of them in the church records. So. Mm.
Tell people how to reach you. What's the website?
So the website is witnessstones.org,
mm-hmm,
and it's Witness Stones is three S's in the middle, so just so people get that. And to email me, they could email me at Dennis,
mm-hmm,
at witnessstones.org. And that would give them that could bring them to us if they're interested in doing it. On the website, we kind of have, if you're a parent and you're interested in doing this, these are the steps you might want to go through. If you're a teacher, these are the steps. And if you're a historic organization, because those are the types of people who are coming to us right now. And it's exciting. I just had a new, a new inquiry yesterday from Killingly, Connecticut, which is up in the northeast corner.
Mm-hmm.
And the big town in Killingly is Danielson. And I already have a record of Mrs. Danielson, I forget her first name, who went to Boston and purchased an enslaved woman.
Oh, gosh.
So we already, you know, so I already have a little
Connecticut
connection.
Connecticut is rich with this slavery.
Yeah. And so here's a community that its namesake, or the wife of the namesake,
was a
slaveholder. And that's, you know, that's the history of, you know, it's intertwined, and now we're bringing it out, and it's the.
I think it's fascinating.
Yeah.
I think we are at the right time to sort of have these bigger conversations.
Yes, I feel that this is happening. You know, certainly, Brian Stevenson at the Equal Justice Initiative down in Alabama, he's doing some crazy work with lynching and that lynching museum.
I know, I'm trying to get myself prepared to go to to the lynching.
Yes.
You know, because I'm a huge fan of Ida B. Wells.
Yes.
Because she was an amazing woman that ran around this country trying to get anti-lynching laws passed.
Yeah.
I mean, this black woman at a time, and she was small, and she had a progressive husband who was like, I will stay home with these five kids and you go do this thing.
She's a crazy person.
Oh my God.
Crazy.
And just, I mean, the danger of that alone is breathtaking.
Yeah.
Just breathtaking.
And now Brian Stevenson, because in the North, I feel somewhat it's the history is faded. In the South, it feels like that wound is still fresh.
Well, that's because they have all those damn Confederate things, and
but it, you know,
and
but,
it's still very it's amped up in a different kind of way, right? Yeah, like, and it's not truthful, but it's amped up.
But he's, to me, he's doing God's work.
And, oh, I think so.
And but he's an example of, you know, of trying to tell the stories using the same factual information that we're using, and it's wonderful to see, and that's happening. It's begin to happening around the country.
Yeah.
And so we feel we're part of something. And
oh, I absolutely think you're part of something.
And then we're very excited to be able to have something we could share with the, you know, teachers and students, mm-hmm. and the adults, because we last time we had an installation ceremony, there was about 500 people there, big support from the community, the TV stations, everybody was there, and it's so exciting. We had the ninth generation descendant of enslaved people in Guilford, Pat Wilson Phineas, who just was elected.
Yes,
the first woman of color legislative district,
yes,
up in Ashford and Willington, and she came down and spoke, and people were just in tears because it's a story they have never heard before, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And the story of her family. Her father, who was a Tuskegee Airman, fought in three wars, couldn't get a blanking mortgage up in that area.
And there's Regina Mason, who was here at
Regina's
with her book and the story. That her great-great-great-grandfather.
Yeah, William Grimes.
William Grimes. And then there's a film, because I saw the film. And I know Regina because I met her the times that she's come here,
right,
and presented at the Beinecke and at the New Haven Museum.
Yeah, I met her there also.
Yes, and we're Facebook friends, so.
Hearing her story. That is incredible. And seeing the methods she used to find that out is an inspiration to us when we're trying to uncover the stories here.
Yeah. Thank you, Dennis.
Thank
you. You have to come back so we can have a longer conversation.
Seriously. Before we put the first stone in New Haven, we'll come back.
I want to be a part of this. So however way you can use me in this project,
I will.
I want to be a part of it. Seriously. Because I am fascinated and awed by this work.
Well, we're gonna do something in New Haven, and you're going to be part of it.
I hope so.
Very excited.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Thank you.
Welcome back, Harry. I'm going to be out. Thank you all for listening today. You have Dennis's website. Check him out. Go pay attention to the witness stones. It's incredible. I'll see y'all. I'll be back tomorrow.
wheels keep spinning. Wheels keep spinning to the morning light. Wheels keep spinning. Wheels keep spinning. Wheels keep spinning to the morning light. Wheels keep spinning. Wheels keep spinning. Wheels keep spinning to the morning light. Wheels keep spinning. Wheels keep spinning. Wheels keep spinning to the morning light. Wheels keep spinning.